So welcome back, everyone. We're on our second class of the foundation course, but it's an ongoing course, a Buddhism for Beginners course that's really about bridging the Buddha's wisdom and our immediate life now, our day-to-day modern life. And so we're slowly going through some of the kind of essential points and how to integrate the Buddhist wisdom into our life. And so for those of you who were here last week, we kind of had a general introduction to refuge and what refuge is, you know, that seeking that really deep down instinctual wish for guidance and protection when we kind of cry out help or mum, and how we have a whole lot of worldly refuges at the moment. You know, when things go wrong, we take refuge in sleep or Tim Tams or distraction and busyness, in relationships, all sorts of things. All of these are what we'd say are external kind of refuges. And certainly nothing wrong with these things. I'm not putting any of them down. But as a refuge where we are hoping for happiness and safety and certainty and meaning, it can't be found in those things because those things are so unstable. They're as unstable as we are. So we really have to pick our refuge. And so last week we talked about how to tell if our refuge is a valid one, if it's going to be something that will give us the guidance and protection that we seek. So not necessarily that I expect you to become Buddhists or anything like that, but just so that on our own individual spiritual journey, what we end up putting our trust in, we can be wholeheartedly confident about. So make a really informed decision. We're going to continue on with the refuge theme a little bit today, but also what we're going to talk about today is a quite unique Buddhist attitude of seeing ourselves as being sick. And so I've titled this class, We Are All Sick. And I don't mean to offend anybody. And many times people go, well, you might be, but I'm not. But this Buddhist attitude of viewing ourselves as being sick is very skillful because, for one, it means being sick but not bad. And many times when we feel really down about ourselves, we feel we are bad. There's something wrong with us, or we've done something bad, or we're a bad person, or we'll never be good enough. So there's a lot of judgment in there, not necessarily conscious, but it just happens. It simmers in the surface. Whereas viewing ourselves as sick has built into it this possibility of getting better, that we're not wrong or bad, we're just sick. So that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. But first, what I wanted to do, we can just do a little reflection to set our motivation for the evening. So let's get comfortable. The most important thing when we do any form of reflection or meditation or anything like that is to try and have our posture being relatively alert or straight. So try and straighten the spine and align it from the inside as if there was a thread of light running through your body, just in front of your spine, coming out the crown of your head, and just being pulled upwards from your crown. Feel the weight of your body suspended from this thread of light. And you'll notice you might sit back a little bit to become more aligned. Your spine might become a bit straighter, the natural curvature even out. You'll notice if you're tipping to one side or the other. So just naturally becoming straighter. And then once the spine is aligned, then relax the body and in particular let your shoulders drop. Take a couple of deep breaths. And let any of the tension just fall away from the tips of the shoulders. Feel the stability of your posture and how balanced it is. And just take stock for a moment. Here we are, we might have had quite a busy day, but we've managed to make it to a Buddhist class. And so we must have some purpose. So starting with whatever that purpose was that got us to class tonight, and bring that to mind, because definitely what we discuss and learn and contemplate can go towards that. And then the wonderful thing about setting our motivation or our purpose, our incentive, is that we can adjust our motivation to make sure it's a really big one, so we don't cut ourselves short. So our motivation can be summed up that we ourselves want peace and happiness and a worthwhile, useful, meaningful life. And then we can reflect that this is actually what everybody wants. And regardless of whether we know each other well or not, this we already have in common. We're all here being sincere human beings. You're here wanting to make the most of your life, to be able to solve your own problems, to be able to help others, to become a good person and contribute to the world. So we can set our motivation that everything that we learn goes towards those very extensive goals. May there be no limit to the benefit. May we be able to benefit everyone, eventually the whole world, in the best possible way, by starting right here, learning about our mind and our life. So nice deep breath. Open your eyes if they're closed. And what I thought we'd do is just have the main bit of the presentation. And if you have any questions as we're going through, then please write them into the chat. And I will pause and we can have a face-to-face discussion as well. But let's have a look at this kind of attitude. We're all sick. So one of the things that this is alluding to is that the Buddha's teachings, all of the Buddha's teachings, even the ones that are incredibly rarefied and academic seeming, are not just academic. The Buddha's teachings are actually teachings that we take personally into our own life. So quite different, not just teachings or information to be understood, but to be integrated into our life, to change our life. So quite different from what you'd learn at university. You might learn all about the Buddha's teachings, but not necessarily how to incorporate the Buddha's teachings into your life to become a Buddha. So the purpose, the motivation, say learning Buddhism at a uni, is maybe to get some really interesting information, but also you're getting a degree. Whereas the purpose of the Buddha's teachings is to become a Buddha, is to become completely liberated from suffering and become a Buddha. So for that reason, our approach is really different from ordinary study. And it means that we kind of give up this idea of being a good student or competitiveness or that goal-oriented kind of learning. But we, as we go through reading and listening and watching documentaries and going to teachings, what I do is I think, oh yeah, that's really interesting. Now, how would I apply that to my life? How would that change this week? How would that change things in my life? And then it becomes very exciting. let's see, what else? So This special attitude of viewing oneself as a sick person instead of a bad person. So it's like we're all on the spectrum of being disturbed, of having delusions, having a distorted relationship to reality. And as we know, if someone's kind of, you know, if someone's got the flu and they're a bit grouchy, we understand because we know they're suffering. And so we don't hate them. We don't say, oh, you should get it together or you should know better or all of those things. We understand that they're under, you know, they're being oppressed by their sickness. So it's the same with us. And it's a way of being able to look at people without getting so impatient or intolerant of them. Hello, Marius. Andrew, yes. So let's see. What the sickness is, in particular, is the disturbing emotions. That's the most obvious one. And the disturbing emotions like anger, jealousy, craving, attachment, they're universal. They're not cultural kind of things that, you know, only English people have them or only Australian people have them or, you know, only the people in the olden days at the time of the Buddha, but we're different now. These are universal disturbances in our mind. And, you know, we've been experiencing them as human beings, you know, from the time of when we're in the caves, when we were roaming the great savannas. You know, those people way back in the ancient times suffered jealousy and attachment and loneliness just like us. And because they are universal experiences and they are recognizable, the Buddha was able to diagnose them and then share a cure, which is really fantastic. So the disturbing emotions manifest, though, quite differently. The symptoms are quite different for each of us. And so at first glance, we might think, oh, we have different problems. And superficially, maybe the conditions are different. Maybe we're worried about a job or worried about a family or worried about the virus. So the content, you know, what we're worrying about might vary. We worry about we're too fat or we're too thin or we're not grown up yet or we're too old. But the underlying thing is worry, isn't it? And that's the universal thing. And we can even go a layer deeper than this at looking at the disturbing emotions and how when we are overwhelmed, what we tend to do is blame the circumstances outside of us. We blame the job or the virus or the uncertainty for our unhappiness. Mixing it up that's just a condition, a trigger for our own delusions in our mind that are triggered or awakened when the circumstances come along. So, for instance, you know, many people have said about coronavirus how, you know, it's brought a lot of uncertainty to people's lives. But actually what it's done is revealed the uncertainty that's always there. That uncertainty and helplessness in the face of nature, in the face of the unpredictableness of life, has always been there, but we've just been in denial. And then something like coronavirus comes along and it is inescapable, and that's what we find unbearable. Actually, it's just revealing reality to us, the truth to us. Now, so this quote, as long as we do not recognize we're sick, we will blame external circumstances for our suffering. And as long as we do that, we can never become free because we're always beholden to our circumstances. And can anyone control their circumstances? We can't, even if we were like, you know, the prime minister, we can't control we can't control our ministers, we can't control the security guards, we can't control the virus, we can't control the weather, climate change, global warming. We can't control any of those things. We can't even control the stock market. So, and yet that's where we spend all of our energy, isn't it? Trying to control these external things. So like we were talking about last week, the Buddhist approach is one of becoming an inner being, not necessarily become a Buddhist, but an inner being, meaning doing a whole U-turn with our attitude to look within for the root causes. All these external circumstances are seen as like conditions or triggers. Anyway, this is a little bit from The Buddha's Medicine for the Mind by the Australian Geshe Tashi Sering. It's really nice. The desire for happiness is common to us all. Everyone wants to be happy, but various circumstances prevent this. Why do we encounter frustration and unhappiness instead of the deep and lasting happiness we seek? Could there be a cause, or do happiness and unhappiness just occur randomly? Unhappiness is like a side effect of an illness. If the illness is properly diagnosed and treated, the side effects disappear. Recognizing this, the Buddha diagnosed the illnesses that lead to unhappiness and prescribed a cure for them. The Dharma, the Buddha's teachings, are the Buddha's medicine for the mind. The Buddha knew from experience that unhappiness is a product of disturbing emotions. These emotions have a negative influence on our state of mind and cause us to act negatively. The Buddha realized that if we could uproot disturbing emotions, we would uproot the causes of unhappiness and plant the seeds for true happiness. But as we might expect, the remedy for unhappiness does not come as a pill. Just as if we want to achieve total physical health, we must follow a complete regimen of eating the right food, exercising, and seeing the doctor. Similarly, to achieve a deep and lasting happiness that is free of all suffering, we must also have a comprehensive program. We must learn what causes our unhappiness and how to overcome it, and what causes happiness and how to encourage those things. And finally, we must internalize what we learn and apply it in our lives. It's nice, isn't it? So clear. So, a little reflection. Just think about the last time that you had the flu. And what was your response? Like, just maybe put it into the chat. When you wake up in the morning, you go, oh no, I hope I'm not getting the flu. You have that sinking feeling where you're feeling a bit seedy and you think you might be getting sick. What do you do? What's the first thing that you do? It might be Google your ailments, your symptoms. It might be just stay in bed. It might be go take a pill and soldier on. Okay, is it Christine or Catherine Harding? Let me change your name. Christine, I thought so. Okie dokie. There we go. It's just tell me know who you are. Okie dokie, great. There you are, fantastic. So yes, look for what you can take. So what do you have in the cupboard? What do you have on hand? Uri, the realization that you think it's coming on. Yep. How do I treat it? I need to slow down, need to rest. Marius, honey with lemon. Okay, he's got his tonic. Look for what you can take and keep on going. Yeah. So does anyone go to the doctor? Fight it and keep on going and then surrender to it. Yeah, so before coronavirus is interesting. Remember those ads on telly of it was for some painkiller and it was about soldiering on basically and how you could soldier on and so how you could just take these pills and you could go to work and you could keep on going and keep on being productive. And that really has been our work culture for many years now. to just work on through when you're so tired, when you're exhausted, and when you're sick. And now we've got the long-term kind of result of that, isn't it, of how we can't. Because what happens when we soldier on whilst we ourselves are contagious is it spreads to everybody else. So this is a really interesting analogy. If we think about our emotions and we get really unhappy or frightened or uncertain, we have nagging anxiety, and we just soldier on, don't we? We keep on going to work and whatever, but it all seeps out in our relationships with others, and it colours our relationships with others. So we can't enjoy their company, and they can't enjoy our company. And maybe we get short-tempered with someone, or we retaliate unskillfully with our speech. You know, we say things that later on we regret, that we, you know, just slipped out. And all of those things. And it's kind of like we become contagious. And you might know what it's like to be with someone, if you go to work, with someone who's in a foul mood. And they don't even have to say anything, do they? And it just fills the room. So that's that emotional contagion that we have. But we don't necessarily think of it that way. So I know with myself, you know, first off, I have a bit of denial, not happening, la, 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 la. and then I just take whatever I have to hand, honey and lemon, vitamin C. I've got this list on the bathroom cabinet, you know, gargle with betadine, all of these things, go through whatever it is. And then, you know, it might get really bad. You might actually get quite ill and not realize it. And then, you know, get up in the morning and just fall down on the ground again, which is what happened to me. I thought I was fine, except I fell over and fainted, basically. So then you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh, I wish you had have come in earlier before it got this bad, because now you've got, you know, a secondary bacterial infection in your lungs, or you've got conjunctivitis, or all of these other things. And that's pretty much what happens to us too, emotionally or with our inner life. Things go wrong, we have a trauma, and we just don't necessarily deal with it. We just keep on going just through sheer force, and it can really complicate things. It can mean that we get sicker, that we get more unhappy, that we draw all sorts of wrong conclusions. So, I mean, one of the things that we really want to do is prevention, look after our mind. Just like we look after our body to keep our immune system well, and we try and stay rested, we try and eat, you know, a good diet, all of those things, put in place really good conditions. So the same thing with our mind. We try and keep our mind happy, not distracted, happy-go-lucky, but keep our mind content and calm, and cultivate that inner sense of peace. And how we do that is with meditation, which is what we'll look at in the coming weeks. Because meditation is like a health regime for your mind, just like you need a health regime to keep your body fit. So that's one thing of just keeping that fitness level up, of having a healthy, flexible, open mind. And then if we do that, then we can get inoculated. We can have a vaccine. So, you know, you have a vaccine. It takes a while for a vaccine to take effect, doesn't it? So the same thing with working on our internal life, our emotions, looking at our mind. It takes a while as we start applying these, you know, techniques and investigating what's going on in our mind or our heart. It takes a while for it to work. It's not like, ping, done. It's got to be integrated. And then we become healthy, but then we become a safe person to be with. And not only that, we can help others, which is really great. One of the other things that I noticed about, you know, the flu is everyone's got their go-to thing that they say, oh, you know, try six crushed garlics, or try lemon or honey, or get acupuncture, or you know, have a really hot shower and then a cold shower, all of these things. Or you might just pick up a magazine and see what they, and it's very haphazard, isn't it? So we entrust our health to just stuff we've read on the internet or in a magazine in a waiting room. And, you know, many people go off and take medicine from quack doctors just because they're full of hope, but they haven't actually investigated, is this medicine actually going to work or not? So we really owe it to ourselves, especially on an inner journey, a spiritual journey, that the medicine that we take for the mind, that we investigate it, that we don't just fall for quack doctors or, you know, just made up things, or we will get into trouble. So this analogy, I hope you like it as much as the analogy of the flu, because it's just a way of getting to know ourselves in a way. It's we get a little bit more feedback when it's our physical health, but very similar process with our mental health. And, you know, on the ads on TV, they offer saying now with coronavirus, because there's a huge upsurge in mental health issues, distress. You know, they're saying, look after your mental health. But I find those ads so frustrating because they don't tell you what to do. They just say, look after yourself, go and treat yourself to a spa or something. Well, what if you don't have the money or the time to do that? Then what do? And actually looking after your mental health isn't going and looking after your body like that. They're kind of triggers for looking after your mind. But you can just look after your mind at home with no money. So that's what this course is about, is how do we look after our mental health, which necessarily means looking at what's happening in our mind. And it's great then. It means that even if we don't have time and even if we don't have money, we can still do it, which is excellent to know. So now let's have a look at the illness. What's the time? Yes, so I thought we'd do the more challenging thing kind of at the beginning of the class here, looking at what are called the Four Noble Truths. And then we can get a little bit more into some easier stuff. But the Four Noble Truths, you might have heard about what the Four Noble Truths, the first teaching of the Buddha. So the first teaching of the Buddha, incredibly extensive and incredibly profound. Noble meaning the truths that are seen or experienced by the noble ones. And the noble ones are the Aryas, who I mentioned last week, who are beings that directly see reality, that have a undistorted relationship with reality. So we're not noble beings, and we know we're not because we suffer. And we suffer because we have a resistance to reality. There is a discrepancy between our hopes and expectations and understandings and distortions and reality. And that discrepancy causes stress and suffering. Like angels, nah, Uri, I'm not so sure. Uri, the Aryas are wise. So they're wise, not with intellectual knowledge, but with intuitively, instinctually, and directly understanding reality. like distinguished gurus, well, some gurus may be Aryas, some gurus may have a correct intellectual grasp, and others may have not just the intellectual grasp, but the direct relationship with reality. Where are they? All around the world, all through time. Can we spot them? Can I spot a wise person? Usually we can, because they are undisturbed. But the Aryas are who understand these truths. So let's have a look at what these truths are, and you'll see why they are extraordinary beings. So the first of the Four Noble Truths is to recognize suffering, that there is suffering. It's called true suffering. And this is where a lot of people get the idea, oh, Buddhism is all about, you know, how life is suffering. Life wasn't meant to be easy. So this one is kind of a little bit like, you know, recognizing that you have the flu. You know, we have the flu. We just may as well accept it. But recognizing suffering, there is obvious suffering, misery, you know, sickness, pain, but there are more subtle types of suffering, and that we are not so good at recognizing. And I was trying to think of an example today, and we can use a similar example with, say, the research being done with the coronavirus, with COVID. So at first, when COVID hit, everyone thought it was a respiratory disease, that it affected the lungs. You got it in the lungs, like SARS and MERS. And that was because that was the most obvious symptoms. And then after several months of research, it became apparent that actually the coronavirus is an inflammatory disease, and it inflames the blood cells. So not just the lungs, but, you know, the different organs of the body. So people got rashes on their hands and feet, and they had heart attacks. So it's less obvious. It's a less obvious layer. The symptoms that we see, we can't quite put it together, you know, with the cause and effect. So this is a similar thing with when we're recognizing suffering. So the three types of suffering, we have obvious pain and emotional turmoil. So, you know, when we're upset or anxious, or when we're miserable with the flu. But the second type of suffering is what's called, what His Holiness the Dalai Lama called, the suffering we run towards. And it's seeking refuge in things that don't last. And when they end, we're devastated. So, you know, going out and buying the packet of Tim Tams, you know, enjoying the lovely time that you have with a cat, but then one day the cat dies and you're separated from the cat. Or, you know, seeking a relationship or a family, but then all of the complications and heartache that comes with that, with those relationships. And when it does come, when it changes, when the suffering component of it comes, we're devastated, we're shocked, and we're devastated. So this kind of suffering is called the suffering of change, or changeable happiness, unreliable happiness. It's the suffering we run towards, trying to get money, trying to get a house, trying to get a job, and we get them, and all the disappointments that come, all the uncertainties that come along with it. You know, you get a brand spanking new car, and at the same time you get all the worry that someone's going to scratch it. So this is a slightly more subtle level, isn't it? Because there's a bit of a time lag. The third type of suffering is even more subtle, and it's called or pervasive suffering. And it is the pain of day-to-day existence, of just how difficult it is to look after our body and our life, to deal with uncertainty. How the very fact that we have an uncertain life and a body that we can't control whether we get sick or not means that we act out badly, which means that our life gets more complicated, which means that we get more suffering. So it becomes like a vicious circle. So this recognizing suffering, actually, I think if you've ever been suicidal, you might have actually had a bit of an insight into this, how absolutely miserable life is. And often when you do see this level of misery and how it goes down all the layers, and people go, oh, come on, it's not that bad, or you'll get over it, or whatever, it's a very pat kind of answer, and it doesn't cut it. And I know the few times that I've been suicidal in my life, it has been this kind of insight into just the depths of suffering, but it just didn't go anywhere. I didn't have the rest of the Four Noble Truths. I didn't have the other three. I just had that and left it at that. And so what it seems to be is that if we just stop there and be miserable without knowing that there is the rest of the story, then we end up being really suicidal. And actually the way to stop being suicidal it's not that bad, but is actually to look at the rest of the Buddha's insights. And that will really lead us from that profound realization that we have of suffering to some really deep insights, instead of just trying to patch them up. So Jane, the first type of suffering is just obvious misery. So physical pain, emotional turmoil. Second one, the suffering we run towards. Third one, all pervasive compounded suffering. Yeah, Uri, that's right. Teens, young adults. So because when we're younger, we're not so invested in all of those things like houses and relationships and families, we see clearer. And it can be quite devastating. You know, what is the point with all this misery when everything that I'm striving for brings misery? And when you're young, often the answers people give are not enough. So let's have a look what those answers can be. So the second truth that the Buddha shared with us from his understanding is a truth of origin, so true origins or true causes, meaning that suffering is not random. Everything that we experience isn't random. It's not just chaotic or by chance. If we experience something, necessarily it had a cause. It's an effect, necessarily it had a cause. So we just need to find the cause to get the right diagnosis. And we can. And so especially for young people, it's important to keep searching to find the right diagnosis and not to fall off and become cynical or jaded or, nihilistic and just a party animal. That's kind of like, you know, you have the recognition of the suffering, but you don't go and find the cause. So you miss out on all of that impetus on the first one. So finding the cause, getting a correct diagnosis, that, you know, there's such relief when we can name an illness. You know, if there's something wrong with us and then finally we get diagnosed with it, what a relief it is to put the name on there. Because once there's the name, then there's something that we can do. Also, not knowing what the cause is makes us feel helpless, and that is debilitating. So in a nutshell, the cause of all of our suffering, of all those levels of suffering, isn't out there. It's in our mind. And this is radical. This is a radical way of looking at things. It can never be out there. Those things out there are triggers, what we call in the West triggers, what the Buddhists would call conditions. So it's kind of like if our immune system was strong, if we had a really good immune system and we were immune to the flu, even if the flu was out there, we wouldn't get it. So a lot of the vaccines, you know, for polio, for measles, you have the vaccine. And then even if it's in the community, you don't get it. So in a way, it's like we can look within our own experience to root out the cause of that suffering. And the causes of our suffering are those disturbing emotions, and they're caused by this kind of blanket ignorance that we have. And ignorance is something that we can do something about. The third noble truth, that ending suffering is possible. Or in our Western terms, wellness is possible. If we were to think, well, what is enlightenment? It's like a state of optimal flourishing. It's not some kind of abracadabra, you're enlightened, but it's of optimal of being, flourishing. And we all have this potential. All living beings have a potential for enlightenment. So it's not just, you know, the chosen people. It's not just my people and not your people or anything like that. It's everyone has this potential. Why? Because everyone has a mind, and the nature of our mind is clean and clear. So even if it might be totally polluted at the moment, it can always be unpolluted. That's its nature. So this is great, because often in Western psychology, for instance, the idea of ending suffering is just way too extreme. It's just like too many expectations. You know, the most we can hope for is to learn to live in society without causing too much trouble. But the Buddha says, forget about that. We can, not only can we learn to live with our problems, we can root out their causes so that suffering no longer happens ever again. How amazing. And not only that, but there's a method. So this is the fourth one, super important, that there is, so this number three is called true cessations, cessation of suffering and its causes. And number four is called true paths. There is a method, and there are many different methods taught by the Buddha for all of us, different types of people with different dispositions. So just like, you know, if you go to the gym, there are different exercise machines for different levels of fitness. And you don't just start on the top one. You start on the easy one, don't you? You start on the one that's going to have the most immediate effect and benefit on you to start with, so you get some concrete results straight away. And you make sure you have some help with someone. You don't just go, oh, that looks like an interesting piece of equipment and jump on it. Otherwise, you're going to end up in funniest home videos. So, you know, there are many different methods, and we just got to get with the program. And that's, so this course is a way of starting off so that we can, our way can be sure. Because, you know, there's such a wealth of Buddhist books out there now, and incredible teachings and everything on the internet and YouTube and whatever. Oh my gosh, where do we start? So we've got to make sure, you know, that we have a method and that we start applying it. And, you know, we might feel a bit overwhelmed, but if we look at how people train for the Olympics or athletics, you know, they train pretty much day and night for, say, 4 years in a row. And, you know, then someone wins gold. So there is a famous Buddhist retreat, a 3-year, 3-month, 3-day retreat, in which, you know, people can have really substantial realizations. Shamatha, you know, calm abiding, insight, in less time than it takes to train for the Olympics. Okay, so the first one, true sufferings. Second one, true causes. Third one, true cessations. Fourth one, true path. So number one, Jane, is true sufferings, recognize suffering. Yeah. So here's a way that we can understand it with our sickness analogy, taking the teachings as a personal instruction. And so, you know, the Buddha is like a doctor. A doctor who's a good doctor, who can actually diagnose the illness. And then the doctor prescribed a cure from his own experience of becoming healed himself. And this analogy of the doctor is fantastic, because often, you know, if someone's sick and you go and see a doctor, everyone says get a second opinion, don't they? So they're already going, check out the doctor. Make sure the doctor's, you know, wise, has experience. Has he cured anyone in the past? Is he in the pay of the drug companies? All of those things. So just like we check out and make sure we have a good doctor and not a quack doctor, the same thing that the Buddha, when we check out the credentials of the Buddha, you know, was there anything in it for the Buddha to have followers? you know, did he make any money from it? Did he get status and all of those things? And so you can go through those tick boxes that we looked at last week of a valid refuge. You know, did he teach the poor as well as the rich? You know, was he equally kind to those who agreed with him as who disagreed with him? All of those things. But also when we look for a doctor, what we're interested in a doctor is someone who can heal our illness. We're not interested that they have the same music taste as us, or they dress well, or, you know, they don't even need to speak the same language as us. We can have an interpreter. So when we're on a spiritual path, it's important that we know what we're looking for. We're not just looking for entertainment or to feel nice. We're not just looking for someone that we like, you know, a doctor that we like being with. We actually want a doctor that can help us. So when we look at the, say, for instance, university professors that teach Buddhism is quite different because it doesn't necessarily come from their own experience. They haven't necessarily applied it to their own lives. So the Buddha actually diagnosed the 84,000 delusions that cause suffering and prescribed a cure for them. And not just theory, not just made up, but evidence-based. So in our Western tradition, there's been a lot of made-up stuff in the Western, you know, in the medical tradition, in the psychiatry tradition. You know, in the medical tradition, there were all sorts of crazy ideas at what caused illness. You know, back in the time of the plague, they thought it was miasma in the air, all of those things. It took a lot of research for it to become evidence-based. And in psychiatry, you know, there was hysteria and the humours, and homosexuality was counted as an illness, and all of these things, just made-up theories, not evidence-based. The Buddha's teachings are really interesting because they're evidence-based, and applying them, we get the result, which is happiness, less delusions. Okay, so taking from Buddha's perspective, we take a plant, cure our unhappiness, delusions or aversions. It could never cure it. No, a plant could help. It could trigger something, but unless we actually remove the root cause from our mind, it might temporarily cure an illness, but it doesn't cure the potential for us to become sick. And that's what the Buddha's teachings are about, just removing the potential to be sick altogether. So instead of going through the 84,000 delusions one by one, it's just like removing the cause altogether. Okay, so then the next one, which is seeing the Dharma as the medicine, internalizing the teachings by applying them in our life to ourselves with regular practice. And this is the one that I love because it's like, you know, if we just have an academic interest in Buddhism, it's like collecting all the, you know, Dharma books and got all these different books on the go. We're really interested in this and that and whatever. But until we actually apply it in our life, it's like collecting the prescriptions, having a pile of prescriptions and never actually getting them filled and never taking them. It's just like, oh, come and look at my prescription collection. I've got this one and that one and la, 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 la. And I can say all the big words and the names. But it's not actually applied Buddhism, is it? So that's a thing. We do all of our study, we get the prescription from the doctor, and then we go and get it filled. And then what do? We've got to internalize it. Literally, you've got to take our medicine and we've got to do it. You don't just take the whole bottle all at once, do you? It's got to be measured out every day and become a practice. It's such a good analogy, this one. I remember reading a book about a country doctor in Siberia. Might have been Solzhenitsyn, I can't remember who wrote it now. But anyway, out in the Siberian steppes or whatever it is, you know, the desert there, so cold. And the people there had whatever, various illnesses or flus. And, you know, he was prescribed all of the medicine for them. And for the first couple of days, everybody started getting better. And then suddenly they're all at death's door. And he's like, what happened? You know, everyone was on the mend. And then it turned out what happened was they just got sick of taking one pill each day and went, bugger it, and took the lot. So, of course, they took all 30 pills at once and almost died. And that's us. You know, we're quite extreme. We find something that we love and we just dive in and we try and take everything that we possibly can. And I just want it now. And, you know, if by the next day we're not happy, we're like, oh, that's no good. Buddhism doesn't work. But actually, what if our prescription goes not just for 30 days, but it goes for 6 months? And have we taken it every day? Now, have we taken it according to the instructions? So His Holiness the Dalai Lama says you can take up to 5 years to check out, does Buddhism work or not? Read something, put it into practice, check for the rest of your life, how is your life going? And do this consistently and then look back at the end of each year and go, how has it been? Have I been able to apply it? And what's been the result? Does Buddhism in general acknowledge a necessity for Western medicine or seen it unnecessary? No, it's very necessary, because Western medicine works on, you know, that first layer of suffering. And if we are overwhelmed by physical suffering or mental suffering, it's very difficult to concentrate on anything else, isn't it? It's really hard. We need to have fairly good conditions to be able to progress, unless we're a strong practitioner and we can take those distressing situations into the path, you know, and say every time that we become depressed, it opens our heart and we become more compassionate towards everybody else. But most of the time, we just get overwhelmed by our suffering, don't we? So Western medicine is very good at that. Actually, any form of medicine is really good at that, to alleviate that suffering. But then what happens? We get better, we forget all about our internal life, we just go out and party again. So it's like it's a step in the right direction, but it's not the end story. If we really want to heal the mind, our experience of suffering, our experience of the flu, or our experience of depression, then we have to heal the mind. But, you know, Lama Yeshe said to be able to do that, we actually have to be quite strong. So we have to build up our internal fitness, our resilience, to be able to look at the mind. So, yeah, we need to have fairly good conditions, or at least one good friend that supports us, really good advice, and enough discipline, internal discipline, to be able to put it into practice, or we're not going to be able to internalize the medicine. We won't remember to take it every day. Okay, Uri, it took me 5 years just to become receptive to the teachings. Why did it take so long? You're not the only one, Uri. I think, you know, we have many internal obstacles. We have doubts. We have distractions. We don't really spend that much time on it in terms of relative to what how much time we spend on other things like shopping or cooking. So internalizing the Dharma means that we don't just say set up a nice altar and think that's practicing the Dharma, that's practicing Buddhism. It means that when we have a challenging situation, we look at it with new eyes, with our Dharma eyes, and go, what would the Buddha say? What would the Dalai Lama say? What would the Dalai Lama do? Yeah, so if we kind of, if we've got all of the things that we chant and a nice altar and all those kind of things, but we don't actually apply patience when we meet someone who annoys us, then we're not practicing the Dharma. We're not taking our medicine. We've missed an opportunity. So I'll give you an example about this. I'm not sure if I said this last week, but it's worth saying anyway. You know, years ago in we had a university professor come into class, and she was coming to this course, And she was going, you know, I've read the Lam Rim, I've read this book, you know, on Buddhism, and this book, and, you know, this philosophical one, and I want something more advanced. And she was so unhappy, and it didn't matter what advanced books that she got. She could go more and more intellectual, but it wasn't helping. And actually, the Lam Rim, the graduated path to enlightenment, which is like this, seemingly very, very basic, until you try and put it into practice, and then it's really, really challenging. So if you're just looking at the Buddha's teachings academically, you might think it sounds a bit simplistic, and that may be fair enough, until you try and practice patience, or practice equanimity, or not get angry at someone who's harmed you, or, you know, equally care for the oppressor and the oppressed. Then it's really hard. Then it's like, oh gosh, give me something simple. So there's a really big difference between this academic approach and learning the Dharma so that we can apply it, internalize it. Yes, Holiness said, my religion is kindness. That's right. Yes, and that really is internalizing if we try and practice kindness. So, you know, this university lecturer, what was so tragic was she was incredibly intelligent and very well read, and it never occurred to her that there was anything missing in her approach, that there was anything to do with bringing it into her life. And so what happened was she knew more and more and became more and more miserable. She knew more and more about all the weird epistemology workings of the mind, but becoming more and more depressed. So it is possible that you can spend years and years and years coming to a Dharma center or reading Dharma books, and if you haven't applied it in your life, what happens, you just become like a grouchy old man or a grouchy old woman. And that's not the fault of the Dharma. That's just because we've been collecting the medicine bottles and going, look at this pretty bottle and look at my collection. So I'm really laying it on thick now, because I'm so concerned that, you know, if we get off on the right foot like this, then we won't waste our energy and our time. We won't get demoralized. So the last one then, the Sangha, the nurses. The nurses who break everything down into bite-sized pieces, into palatable chunks. And, you know, when I first came to Lungri Tumpa Center, there was only about 20 or 30 books that had been translated, you know, that of the Lam Rim, you know, in the Gelupa tradition, hardly anything. There was just these, and you just read whatever you could get your hands on. Now there's hundreds and hundreds of books. We have a wealth of information. And I don't know about you guys, but you might be thinking, where do I start? And how do I know what I'm got my hands on is valid, is worthwhile, trustworthy? So this is where we need the Sangha, who we can think of as the nurses, who just come around each day and say, just do this bit. There's all the pills in the universe, but take these pills at these times. So it's like having a, you know, a lama, or a monk or a nun, or, you know, for beginners, for someone like me that can go, this is my experience, just try and do this bit, get this one down, and then the next step, and you'll be fine. So those palatable pieces, especially when we're new and our life is chaotic and we don't know what we're doing, that's when we need help to just have it handed to us bit by bit. So having a guru is like this, that they can see exactly what it is that we need that day, that week, that year to practice from their own experience and their own wisdom. It's not just some idea. You know, someone like me, I might have an idea, but we really want to go and find someone who really knows, who has that wisdom. So the Sangha are the Arya Sangha, like we talked about last week, who have a unobstructed insight into reality. So, of course, they're peaceful, calm, wise, fair, loving, compassionate, have total equanimity. The Sangha are also the ordained monks and nuns. The Geshis, who are also necessarily monks or nuns. The Sangha are also our spiritual peer group. So like us together doing this class together, we're like lay Sangha. We're a spiritual community where we're on the same page. And how important that is to finally be in a group where we feel this connection rather than being the odd one out or being thought of as crazy. So I found this so beneficial that just to know there are other people on the same page as me, even if I don't know them, immediately don't feel quite as alone anymore. So at our level, where should we go? Do we come to me? Well, I'm kind of more like, like in the hospitals, how they have like the tea lady that comes around and, they might know the workings of the hospital and stuff, but they might show you to the right doctor or the good nurse or whatever, something like that. I am an FPMT registered teacher, so I have done some study, and whenever I lead a class, I really try and be clear for you so you know exactly where you stand, what the Buddha's teachings are, what's in my experience, from my own experience, and if I don't know something, I'll tell you, I don't know, I'll find out. So at least that way, then you can make an educated decision. But again, when we're looking for a spiritual community, we want to have a spiritual community that is sincere and wise. So not just, I spend a lot of my time back in the day, drinking lots of vodka and spending time in pubs, and just the people I spent time with were people who were fun to be with. And the advice that they give wasn't very good. I got into a lot of trouble. So I've actually found, that really good friends that I have are the friends that I like being with them, but they'll also tell me if I'm stuffing up. And I mightn't like them for that, but I value that. And I feel I can rely on them. So we've got to make sure that we have some friends like that, that we may not see them all the time because they might say a few too many hard truths. But we really must make sure we have a friend like that just in ordinary life. But then also we need to make sure that in our Dharma studies, the information that we get is correct. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of stuff online, Facebook groups and all sorts of things where people might say that they're Buddhists. They might have all sorts of academic knowledge. They may show off about it. But you've got to be careful. They're not just what I'd call hobbyists, but they're actual practitioners. And you can tell by the tone, are they mean when they write on those Facebook posts? Are they skillful? Do they lead you to a realization, or are they telling you? So even that, you've got to be careful. And if we're just hanging out with academic Buddhists or hobbyists, people that dabble, but have not necessarily in direction of in life, then that will wear off on us. So I always try and go to Geshe Zopa's teachings online every Sunday at 5. Geshe Zopa, one of the great lamas in our organization, because he's the real deal. He has insights and he's learned and he's so kind, so respectful of everybody. He's really extraordinary. The registered teachers in our organization, the touring lamas, both men and women, they are really extraordinary. And through my own research and checking with everybody else, I can put my trust in them. Meanwhile, then whatever Dharma center you end up with, check them out. Check out set some little tests in your mind. how do these Dharma friends of mine deal with difficulty? Are they flexible? Can they change plans easily? Do they get grouchy? Do they talk badly about people behind their backs? All of those things, just like we would do to check out, do we have a really good friend or not? That's at the minimum. And many times, you know, just like if we get the flu, we might ask our friend, what do you do when you get the flu? And we're just going to get whatever insight they have. The best insight is to ask the doctor. So the same with the mind. We might ask our friend, what do you do? But if we really want to be healed, we've got to go straight to the source. So we have the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, which is the actual refuge. And then we have the Sangha, those practitioners on the path who are putting the teachings into practice and can share their experience with us. That's who the Sangha are. And they're the ones that we want to have their advice and their company. So we have a little reflection, shall we? Before we have a reflection, so what else? Any other questions about this? Seeing the, you know, the Buddha as the doctor, the great physician, the Dharma, the actual refuge, the medicine for the mind, the Sangha, the spiritual helpers. What other kind of questions or comments or anything at all? Let me know. Even if it's your first time tonight, you may not even be familiar with these terms, and that's perfectly okay. I can you know, have I written them in the in the, I'll write them in the chat, or you know, there's the screen share there. How do we hear Geshe Zopa? So on our homepage of our website, I've got like an ad for Geshe Zopa. There, it's kind of got a yellow background. So it's on YouTube every Sunday live at 5 o'clock. And so, you know, there's a little YouTube chat going on that's really nice as people all around the world tune in, but also those teachings stay up there on YouTube. So they are in-depth teachings on thought transformation. So, you know, what I'd say is just take a relaxed, open-minded approach and don't try and understand everything all at once. But I just find, you know, even taking teachings from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, whether like in person, you know, when he's doing a tour, or whether it's on YouTube online, there will be a part where it's quite general, and then there will be a part like a really deep dive into Buddhist philosophy and practice. And that can be just, whoa, there can be a whole lot of lists of this and that and all of this terminology that we've never heard before. So if that happens, instead of getting overwhelmed, what you do is you just sit back and enjoy being in the presence of a master. And with someone like Geshe Zopa, you know, it's quite rare in our culture to have a man who is authoritative and kind and open. You know, how rare is that? You know, we look at our politicians, basically. That's the role models that we've got. So just being in the presence of someone like that is a tonic. It's really heartening, and it somehow redresses the balance that you get this experience over an hour or two of a human being who's just amazing. And even if you don't understand a word of what he said, that in itself is healing, isn't it? Just to know there's other really good people in the world. Okay, gurus and geshis and monks and nuns. Yes, so there's a whole range of terminology here. So monks and nuns are ordained people. They're renunciates, just like monks or nuns in any tradition, a Christian tradition or anywhere. So they've taken vows similar to, you know, like we hear poverty, chastity, obedience. You know, so they have renunciate vows, and they've renounced worldly life. They've renounced having families or making money or a career or status and what kind of hairdo they've got. They've renounced all of that. And usually it's a life of service to help others. So to become a monk or a nun, you don't like have an exam, a goodness exam. You just have a real yearning to renounce the worldly life and to take on those vows. Everything else in your life may be a mess, but you have that that real yearning to become a renunciate. So many times people think, oh, monks and nuns must be really wise, or they must be really together. Not necessarily. They've taken the Buddha's vow, so we, you know, really honour them for that and pay respect to that. But they're also human beings like us with their difficulties and trials and tribulations too. Then Geshis. Geshi is an educational qualification like professor. You get a Geshi degree. It's between 15 and 25 years of study. A Geshi, you can see Lama Zopa Rinpoche here behind me has the Geshi degree because he's got the monk's robes and the shirt that they wear underneath, maroon and yellow, and that yellow means he's a Geshi. So he has his educational qualification. And to become a Geshi, a male Geshi La or Geshi Ma, a female Geshi, you need the qualification, but you're also still a monk or a nun. So you're also still a renunciate. But the Geshi qualification is like an academic one. So they know all the texts. They can quote scripture to you. They always have a valid source. But they may not necessarily be meditators. So then we have like, you know, the great meditators who you might call yogis. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche is a great meditator, a great yogi as well. So you don't necessarily have to be a monk or a nun to be a great meditator, a great yogi, an incredible practitioner. So there are many really outrageous stories about Buddhist yogis that have incredible insights. But, you know, they were hermits or they roamed around giving teachings or being really eccentric, but really amazing practitioners. So then when we talk about a guru is someone that we take as our spiritual guide, so a spiritual friend. So we might have a best friend who's our bestie. We have our worldly refuge, mom and dad, or gambling and Tim Tams, whatever it is. But a guru is a spiritual friend. And that means that what they are is qualified to lead you on a spiritual path to enlightenment. So if you take someone as your guru, if you wish someone was your guru, you must find out, can they lead you to enlightenment? Do they meet those qualities of a valid refuge? Are they a valid guru? And that's something to not jump into, but to really check out. Because otherwise you can be very, you can have great sincerity and yearning, but you end up devoting yourself to a quack doctor or a charlatan, which happens so often, doesn't it? Okay. Christine, when you frustrated yourself and haven't applied the teachings appropriately, how do you take stock of that? Where do you go back? Oh, yeah, so that's just like going, like me, you know, I got the flu, or I got some bladder infection, you know, and I got all the antibiotics and I take them for 3 days and then I forget. So then I get my infection back again and now I'm immune to those antibiotics and they don't work anymore. So I just blown it, you know, so I just made life more complicated. How many times have we done that? You know, we're just stuffed up. It's what happens. It's okay. We're samsaric beings. We're stuck in all of this confusion. The Buddhas understand that. The Sangha understands that. So then we just got to get a new prescription, a new program, and start applying it. It's okay. We can start again. Okay, so the best website to learn about wordings and terminology and things, Anderson, a really good one is called Study Buddhism. And it's Alexander Berzin's website. And I have a link to it. If you go to our links page on our website, it's way down the bottom. It's on the very, very last line and it's called Study Buddhism. And that is an excellent place to start because Alexander Berzin, you know, he's a Westerner, he's contemporary, but he's also highly learned academically and he's also a practitioner. So it's fantastic. And a huge amount of information there. So you can just pick a topic like patience and just see, or the mind, or gurus, guru devotion, and then start reading there. Really good place to start. Yes, some solitude seems essential in finding peace. And it's just like when we're ill, you know, people say rest. And how many of us can? And how hard it is when we can't rest, how hard it is to get well. And it's the same with our spiritual journey. We need some peace and quiet. We need some solitude to actually do that internal work. We need to create that space within us. And if we don't, it's going to be a really hard slog. And we go, I know, I should rest. And we all know how that turns out. How it turns out is we just collapse in a mess, you know, which is, you know, we have a nervous breakdown where we have to rest. We have to stop. So we don't want to let it get that far. So what that means is creating space, carving out some space and taking it from the important but later on to the important urgent pile. And making some space every day to be quiet, to be courageous, to look at the contents of your mind. Yeah. Nowadays, women's spirituality is stronger than male spirituality in the Western world. I don't know, Marius. I find that women are more comfortable in a spiritual exploration because they're more used to a psychological one. Just, you know, through socialization. Men are more comfortable maybe with an academic exploration. When it comes to masculine or feminine spirituality, within Buddhism, there is both. Because from a Buddhist point of view, the mind has no gender, neither male nor female, or has both. And so there are different approaches and meditations that bring out the masculine types of mind or qualities and bring out the feminine types of qualities. So it's really wonderful that way, really balanced, holistic. So the masculine types of qualities are to do with compassionate activity, and the feminine types of activities are to do with wisdom. So it's a little bit like in the ancient world, you had Sophia, you know, the goddess of wisdom. So from a Buddhist point of view, the wisdom side of things is looked on as the feminine. By the by. Okay, so I think I've covered those questions. Let's do our little reflection, shall we? Just to sum up with this one. So let's do just a short reflection. Take a nice deep breath. Let out stale air from the lungs. And let's have a look at who we actually put our faith in and what qualities we look for in a doctor. So we've recognized we're sick. We recognize that we're under the influence of the disturbing emotions. We know we're sick because we've got the symptoms, unhappiness, stress, boredom. And then we look for a doctor to help us. So when we look for a doctor, we don't necessarily need them to give us dietary advice or advice about the movies or dress sense. Or any of those things. We wouldn't ask a doctor, which school should I send my kids to? What we're looking for is, how do I get healthy? And we want to make sure that they have our best interests at heart, that they don't have any hidden agenda. And a doctor doesn't even need to have a good bedside manner, do they? They just have to be really good at what they do. So when we're on a spiritual journey, we need to find a doctor that is skilled, that has healed others, that that is evidence-based and is impartial with no favoritism. And then the medicine. So what qualities do we look for in medicine? You know, maybe when we were kiddies, we just wanted medicine that tasted nice and we didn't want the medicine that tasted bad. We pushed the spoon away, we threw a tantrum. But you know, now that we're a bit older, if you've ever had Chinese medicine, for instance, or acupuncture or chemo, you know, those medicines are terrible. They're very unpleasant, but why do we take them? Because we have faith that they will help us and work for us. And even if they're difficult, we're happy to take them. So with our study of the Dharma, to not just read the stuff that's nice or not just read the stuff that agrees with our existing worldview, but to delve into the difficult stuff with relish. And to be willing to take it on, to put it into practice, to put the effort into that discipline of doing practice every day, looking at our mind, taming our mind, like a fitness regime, taking our prescription. And for the nurses, the helpers, just contemplating what happens when we spend most of our time with really negative people. How does it affect our mind? And what happens when we spend most of our time with really positive people or wise people? And can we notice when that's happening? So make a determination to each week spend some time with some wise, like-minded people that can help you, that are more advanced than you, so that you can slip into their slipstream, be energized by them. Okay, so nice deep breath. Open your eyes if they're closed. Let's go the last bits. So the benefits of actually having a refuge, finding a refuge. We talked last week about a valid refuge, and this week how to actually practice that refuge with this attitude of seeing ourselves as sick and able to be healed. So if we do actually put this into practice, the benefits are quite extraordinary. And one of them is we stop being distracted. So I found this really interesting because, you know, how many times have we started off in the day, oh, I'm going to do this, 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 and this, and we get to the end of the day and we haven't done anything on the list. We've just been frittering our time away. So that happens because our refuge isn't strong. If we have a strong refuge, we stay focused. We have that big picture. We never kind of waste our time as a natural thing. It also means our path through life becomes clear. We know what the meaning of our life is. So last night I saw in the news this lady who you might have seen, she just put her shopping bags down. And just stepped away on this. She put her shopping bags down on the side of the curb just after coming out of the supermarket. And she just stepped away for some reason. I didn't hear why. Maybe to see somebody or do something. And she two steps away and this car came careening down, an old person that had a health episode, and crashed, smashed right through all of our groceries and into the shop. And if she hadn't have stepped away, at that moment, she would have been plowed over and dead. And she said she felt so grateful and that there was some reason that she was alive and now she must find a meaning in life. And she said on the news, it was quite amazing. And Now I have to find the meaning for my life because I'm still here. So this is this incredible thing that happens. You know, we have a near-death experience. We're so grateful we're still alive, but do we even know why? So when we have a valid refuge, we know why we're alive. We know the meaning of our life. The path through our life becomes clear. And this is a yearning that we have anyway, deep instinctual yearning to make our life meaningful, to find what's the meaning of our life. So this is it. And from, you know, I mean, the pat answer, a Buddhist refuge, is to become a Buddha, to be able to help all others. But actually, we get this feeling of this, of our life path becoming clear when we start actually practicing refuge, investigating the objects of refuge and then how to practice it. Naturally, we become a better human being, a kinder, more tolerant human being. So, you know, as you're going through all the social media posts, if anyone says they're a Buddhist, but they cannot control their speech or their speech is unkind, they're not practicing Buddhist. It's not applied Buddhism. It's academic Buddhism. So you just want to hang out with the people that are actually putting it into practice in their life, that you can feel safe with. And for us, we know we're on the right track when we start becoming a better human being, when we notice we're more tolerant of others. And all of this means we are protected from suffering. It doesn't matter what happens to us. We don't lose our equilibrium. We're not traumatized. Things change, but we're not devastated. And that's really amazing. So we know we're on the right track when we stop overly concentrating on the faults of others and start looking within. So that's that U-turn. I probably put that in for me, for my own benefit, actually, you know, because I'm always looking at what everybody else is doing and analyzing what everybody else is going through. But hang on a second. What about me? What am I doing here? What's my part in it? Where's my business? My part of the story. So we look within at our own contribution first before we blame anybody else. So that's how we know we've got it right. We're on the right track. And then lastly, our goal, what our goal can be. And this too is kind of sums up then, as a Buddhist. I just find it in my pages. Here we are. So generally, we have a goal of, you know, at the very least, we don't want any more suffering in life. You know, we want to go through our life and we don't want it to get any worse. Like, that's our baseline, isn't it? Every day we hope we're going to become happier. We don't kind of think, oh, I've peaked already, from now on it's all downhill. So that's the minimum that we're aiming for. But actually, from a Buddhist point of view, this isn't yet even a spiritual path. This is a worldly path. We're just thinking just this life. Nothing wrong with that. It's a materialist aim. But from a spiritual point of view, we can aim for so much more. And I found it quite interesting that whilst we're just motivated by what's happening now in this life, this week, this year, whatever, it's not a spiritual path, even if we're using spiritual methods. It's very, very short term. So it's whatever gets you there, really. It's okay to start there, but please don't leave it there, because it's very short term. So the moment we start thinking about future lives, then we are on a spiritual path. So whether it's future lives, say in a Christian religion, where you think about what happens after I die, is it up or down? Is it heaven or hell? Or whether we're thinking, say, in a Hindu tradition, am I going to go up or am I going to go down into other lifetimes? Or from a Buddhist tradition, you know, the state of my mind when I die is pretty much going to determine where my mind gravitates to in the next rebirth. And so what I want is not something worse. I want something at least as good as this life now, with the opportunities of this life as a human being now, or better. So the moment we start thinking this big picture, then we are on a spiritual path. And that is a good thing. So then, from a Buddhist point of view, we can be aiming then for individual liberation. So instead of just going up and going down and going around and around and continuously going around and around this cyclic existence, what about if we stopped cycling around and around altogether? So a Buddhist view then is that instead of just aiming for better rebirths in the future, to aim for this complete cessation of suffering altogether, which is nirvana, liberation, a state of everlasting peace that you cannot fall back down from. It cannot ever be disturbed. And why? Because you've removed all of the causes of suffering. So that's like, instead of trying to just get rid of each of those 84,000 delusions, you've removed the cause of delusions altogether. If there's no delusions, there's no cause of delusions, then it is impossible to suffer. You have achieved freedom or liberation. Christine says, is it difficult for true Buddhists to see the suffering that's occurred this year and make sense of it? Yes. So from a Buddhist point of view, everything that happens is grist for the mill. And this in itself is incredibly liberating, because instead of sorting things out into pleasant and unpleasant, we can sort them out into useful. Everything can become useful. Good or bad can become useful. Pleasant or unpleasant can become useful. Whatever happens, the unexpected or the expected, we can accommodate and use on the path to enlightenment. So I'm not sure if that's what you meant by your question, but it means that everything that happens to us, we can use to develop our qualities, our compassion, our wisdom, absolutely everything. And often it is actually the horrible things that happen that we develop our empathy then for others. You know, if we've never had a headache, we're not going to really tolerate anyone who's moaning and groaning about a headache, are we? But the moment we have a headache, we go, oh, I get it. And we become a better human being. So all the turmoil that I've had in my life, I have been able to make sense of, because I can use it as really embarrassing stories in my classes. And I'm talking from my own experience, right? So we have this goal, you know, individual liberation. The Buddhist goal is for oneself, the goal to completely stop this cycle of uncontrolled rebirth and suffering altogether. But this is also a Mahayana Buddhist tradition, which means that there's another step, which is full enlightenment. So not just nirvana, the cessation of one's own problems, but kind of thinking, how on earth Can I rest while others are suffering? You know, like how can I bear the suffering of others? Others are suffering just like I was. How can I leave them there? So the Mahayana goal is to, well, just as an ordinary being, there's not much I can do. But if I became a Buddha, then I would be able to help everybody. I would be able to lead every single living being out of suffering and into a state of lasting peace. So that's this universal goal, the full enlightenment, the Mahayana, the great vehicle, meaning great in terms of number, a great multitude of beings to help. So then you develop all of your qualities, your wisdom, compassion, all of your skills and everything, so you can help others. And the aim is to become a fully awakened Buddha so you can spontaneously and effortlessly and perfectly help others. Have I known anyone in this lifetime who became enlightened? Well, I think someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama is enlightened, is a fully awakened Buddha who has purposefully manifested as a human being so that he's relatable to help us. I think Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche behind me also is a Buddha manifesting as a human being to help us. And if I was a really good Buddhist and remembered all my Buddhist teachings, I would see all of you as Buddhas manifesting as humans to help me get enlightened. Uri, there's another answer to your question, which is yes, of course, there are people, even in the modern days, who become enlightened, who become liberated. All the steps all along the path, of course, many, many, many. But Shakyamuni Buddha, who we're talking about last week and this week, was like a teaching Buddha who demonstrated the whole path to enlightenment so that we have this method that we can follow. So with this goal, when we look at these four different types of goals that we can have, you might find that when you sit down to meditate, you start where you are, a worldly goal. My life has been a mess this week. And then you kind of develop it through. Well, why am I here? Well, I'm meditating more than just for this week. I'm kind of meditating for the rest of this life and possibly the whole big meta picture of this life and what happens in the future. And then we start thinking, well, of course, I want total liberation. But what about the others? So even in one meditation session, we can adjust our motivation. So this is what setting our motivation is about, going through this process to get the biggest possible goal. Or you might just find that there's times in your life where you spent, you know, several years in just the worldly goal. I just don't want to suffer. And then maybe you started thinking about, well, I want to make this life meaningful and I want to make sure that when I die without fear and that whatever happens, it's going to be good, not bad. And then you might come across Buddhism and you might, you know, have this revelation. Wow, it is possible to achieve liberation. Wow, I'm going for that. And you might go for that for several years. And then you might start becoming interested in the Mahayana, you know, in the world. How can I really help the world? So it might come over the, you know, a whole process throughout your life. Or you might just resonate with one of these steps and that's it. So it's quite a different ways that we can have all goals simultaneously, or we might just go through a process. And there are stages on the Buddhist path and there are Buddhist teachings that are tailor-made for each of these steps along the process, along the path. And because we're a Mahayana center, we kind of go through all of these, but we always try and make it the really big one and end up with the really big one, because then we get everything else in between. It takes a lot of courage to have this universal goal, but all you need to do is look at the news and it's the only possible response, isn't it? Otherwise, we just get so, you know, upset about everything and feeling helpless. But hey, there is something that we can do, but it is very big picture. So what else? Any other comments or questions? I haven't given you much of a chance to talk, have I? I've gotten too used to leading these classes where everyone just puts all of the their comments and questions into the chat. So it just seems to be how it's going at the moment. And is there anything else? Any other last comments or anything? Yes, the graduated path. The Lamrim, the graduated path to enlightenment, the step-by-step path to enlightenment, or as Venerable Robina calls it a course on how to become a Buddha, the ultimate course. Yes, it does go through all these stages. And so what it's called is the three scopes, the teachings in common with the lower scope, all the teachings and practices in common with the middle scope and those in common with the great scope. So the lower scope teachings, you know, they're in common with a materialist, with a just not wanting things to get worse. The teachings in common with the middle scope are to do with liberation, how to liberate one's own mind. So, you know, that's for everybody. And then the teachings in common with the great scope is, and then if we want to become a Buddha, how do we progress along the path to help all sentient beings? So, yeah, what an extraordinary, you know, it really is the nectar of the Dharma, the medicine of the Dharma is there, the ultimate medicine for our mind to heal all suffering and become, you know, fully awakened or healed, a Buddha, to help others. So I'd like to dedicate that, you know, just by talking about it tonight, may it be the seeds in our mind that we can accomplish this great undertaking. And like His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, never give up. You know, it's always possible. Be kind wherever possible. It's always possible. And never give up. And we don't have to give up because it is possible to become a Buddha. It's in our nature. So let's dedicate that just by everything that we've talked about tonight, may it come to fruition. May we be able to be liberated from all of our sicknesses, our delusions, our suffering. May we apply the medicine and enjoy it. May we become ultimately healthy, fully enlightened, awakened, and then be able to help everybody else become healed as well. So thank you so much, everyone, for coming, and hope to see you next week. And stay safe and stay well. Lovely spending time with you all.